post a PowerPoint based on what I'm doing today. If you just Google Google D. Pelkovitz, that's D-P-E-L-C-O-V-I-T-Z, at Google Sites, I'll God willing, tonight I'll post it under recent lectures, under new lectures, okay? Yeah, under this title of whatever. Okay? Okay, great. So let me get a sense of the audience. Hi, everybody. How many of you came here because you want to focus on family in Israel? Not necessarily. How many of you are expecting me to talk about, in general, helping people coping with tough? Okay, that seems to be the consensus. Okay, fine. So it'll be a more general kind of thing. The reason I thought of this is that recently, after some tragedies in the community, both in Israel in terms of Har Nof, but also in general, any tragedy, somebody's in a serious accident, somebody in the family has a terminal illness, or even if you have a friend who has a child who is, born with a severe developmental disability, whatever it might be, the question is, how do you reach out in an appropriate way with people to find the right balance? You don't want them drowning in the chicken soup of our love and support, because chicken soup can kill, and yet you don't want to not be responsive to their needs. So I'm going to talk about this from the standpoint of first talking about the connection component. How do you find that balance? Then I'm going to go to talk a little bit about connection over time, because connection right after an initial diagnosis, let's say, or right after the initial shock, it could be a recent divorce that's brewing, it could be a recent death, God forbid, of a family member, it could be an accident. I mean, life, to a certain extent, is filled with various kinds of challenges. And I always think about the Chinese word characters for crisis is two word characters. The word character for danger and the word character for opportunity. And I want to talk about this both from an opportunity standpoint, but also I find that very often people they respond to not quite knowing what to do or how to be helpful, by either pulling back completely, which is never a good idea, nobody ever feels good about that, or by unconsciously or consciously trying to avoid the person, or by just doing the wrong thing. So I want to talk about this from a standpoint, I'll bounce off of some Jewish thought as we talk about it, and hopefully we should have enough time in the next 45 minutes or so to be able to deal with these main issues. Point number one is to realize that you can't mess it up. As long as you're there, as long as you're just there by somebody's side, it's not what you say. People often get totally thrown by, what do I say? I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm afraid I'm going to somehow mess it up. And then they talk themselves into a level of anxiety that they just avoid, which is never the right thing to do. The answer is to think about it not as an event, but as a process. Just being at somebody's side is something that we often underestimate how powerful it is. Again, it's not what you do. It's just being there. It's being there. That's why we have in the title, Nose Ba'ol Im Chavero. You know, bearing the burden together with somebody. Listen to this research, fascinating research. Let's say somebody's husband is undergoing a painful medical procedure, and the wife is in the room during the painful medical procedure. If she holds his hand during that period of time, the ratings of pain will go down significantly. Literally, your perception of pain shifts. But let's say the marriage isn't so great. the research shows it doesn't help so much. If somebody who you're angry at is holding your hand, maybe it even heightens your pain, it probably makes the pain go up. But then, in a fascinating study, they did marital therapy on these couples that they were researching. So they had the relationship. And after the relationship was improved, the analgesic benefits of a wife holding a husband's hand or vice versa came right back. So it's literally tied to our hearts bouncing off each other. That's a very important component that I wanted to talk about. It's literally, we somehow, when we are at somebody's side, when they're going through physical pain or emotional pain, it literally changes things. It literally changes the experience of pain and even impacts, in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, we talk about how it impacts even on the strength of the immune response. So let me share with you a brief story. A few years back, I gave a talk in Israel, and I didn't want to take any money. It was a stucca that I didn't want to, I didn't want to benefit from in any direct way. So they were grateful, and they gave me like a very nice painting when I came home. It was by a well-known Israeli artist. So I thought it would look nice in my office across the street here in Belfer Hall. So I unwrap it to hang it up on my wall in Belfer Hall, and an envelope falls out of the back. And I open it up, and it says, dear Dr. Pelkovitz, it's just to tell you that I assume that you're the son of Rabbi and Mrs. Ralph Pelkovitz. My father was a rabbi, my mother was a Rebbetzin for many years. And they said, here's what she says. This is almost 70 years later. She said, about 60 to 70 years ago, I was 4 years old, and your father was my rabbi, your mother was our Rebbetzin. And at age four, my father died suddenly. When I heard you were coming to town, I was determined to write this letter. She said, because all I remember from that time is as a frightened, lonely, sad, panicked four-year-old is what got me and my mother through the horrible time of our loss was just feeling the presence of your father and mother at our side. She says, I don't remember a word they said. I don't even remember if they even said anything. Just having your mother sit with us, having your father sit with us and be at our side. That's literally nosei ba'olam chaveiro. And we sometimes underestimate the power. It's not about the words. It's about the interacting root system that comes from us being together, you know, side by side. You've probably heard me talk about this in some other contexts. There's the research on mirror neurons, that as I speak to you and I'm moving my hands and looking at you, you wouldn't be surprised to know that there's a dedicated motor neuron in the motor cortex of my brain, and it's going like this. That's not surprising. But what research in the last decade has shown, that as each of you look at me, it has to be only through looking, it can't be through listening. As you look at me, there are mirror neurons in the motor cortex of your brain, and guess what it's doing? It's going like this. It's literally mirroring the hand movements that I have, meaning that we're hardwired for empathy. We're hardwired to be able to share in the pain in a way that literally lessens the pain just by being at somebody's side. Okay, so we're good with that. How many of you heard the thought about the root systems of palm trees and how that works? Do you ever hear this? Let me share it with you, even though it's something I probably talk about too much, but it's worth talking about. I have a friend, I'm going to quote him a little bit later towards the end, a very well-known rabbi and psychologist in California. His name is Rabbi Dr. David Fox. So he told me that once he likes to hike. He was hiking in the desert outside of the Los Angeles area where he lives and where he's a rabbi and a professor, one of the clinical psych programs. And he's a friendly guy. This is in the Palm Desert area. And he comes across a palm tree ranch. He's a friendly guy, David. And he goes over to the rancher. He's all alone there, tending to the palm trees. And he says, tell me something I don't know. I always like learning new things. Tell me something I don't know about what it, you know, what the process is of growing palm trees. So the rancher just doesn't really know what to tell him, but David pushes. He's a very nice guy and a very persistent guy. So finally the guy says to him, listen, let me tell you something that very few people know. If you grow a palm tree in isolation, it will yield dates, but they won't be sweet. They aren't commercially viable. When you have palm tree next to palm tree, growing in a grove with the root systems interacting, that's when it will yield delicious, sweet, commercially viable dates. And David goes back on his hike and he tells me that for the first time in his life, he appreciated what we say a few times every Shabbos, right? We say, Tzadik Katamar Yefrach. You want to live a life of righteousness? It's like a palm tree. It has to be with our root system interacting. It's that support that is just by being there that makes all the difference. You know, it's interesting. In the resilience research, okay, there's 2 points in the resilience research. Number one is they say if you want to know how resilient somebody is in the face of trauma, and you only have time to ask one question, here's the one question you should ask. Do you have one person in your life who you could wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning if you have a problem to talk to them? I read that one morning, that night, at 3 a.m, I get up, I guess my brain told me to get up, and I start shaking my wife, saying, you know, wake up, I have to talk to you about something. She comes jumping out of bed, she says, yeah, what is it? And I said, nothing, just go back to sleep. I just wanted to know. Okay, and luckily she doesn't remember, it was during non-REM sleep. But that's the key question. In the resilience studies, for example, in the island of Kauai, in 1955, a team of researchers studied every child born in the island of Kauai from 1955 to this day. There's a new generation of researchers that took over the study to see who was resilient. It was an area that had a lot of crime, a lot of abuse, a lot of poverty. And what were the main factors that predicted resilience? And what were the main factors that predicted succumbing to the ravages of the abuse and the poverty? And it turned out the top 2 predictors were one person who cares. Again, it's the same thing. It's that root system. And that one person who cares interacting in some way with, actually, they found in this study, active religious beliefs. So that gives you a sense of meaning. So we're going to get to that a little bit later about the meaning-making component of support when somebody's going through a tough time. I have a colleague, Rabbi Rabinowitz. Yeah, please.
Excuse me, you said there are 2 points and you just missed one. What is the second point?
No. So one was waking somebody at 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, the 2 points in the Kauai study?
Yes.
Active religious, people who were actively religious. I mean, just sort of like it's whatever religion brought them. It wasn't the content of the religion. And the other one is one person who cares. Those are the 2 points in the Kauai studies. Yeah, you're welcome. Okay. One last point, and then I'll move on to the next 3 areas I wanted to talk about. And that's a beautiful thought that I heard from Rabbi Rabinowitz, who's a rabbi, a wonderful rabbi in Florida, who's gone through some tough medical challenge in his life. And he points out something that's really pretty amazing. We all know the Hebrew word neshama, for soul. But it turns out there's another word in Hebrew. We see it often in Nach, in Haftorahs, right? So it says in the Haftorah, for example, the Arim Neshamos Yoshiv. It's also Nun, Shin, Mem, He. Same exact letters, but it's pronounced neshama. Not neshama, but neshama. Okay? So the same letters could mean a soul or it could mean desolation. Which is fascinating. And what's the lesson in that? So he pointed out to me once, he said, look at the difference. What transforms neshama, the feeling of desolation, in those 4 letters? Okay? From desolation to a neshama, to a soul, He says it's just taking the patach of neshama, right, the patach of desolation, and a little bit of support by adding the kamatz. That's all it takes to go from desolation to support. It's a simple concept, but I think an incredibly powerful concept. So that ends part one. Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how hard, this is part two, how hard, am I okay with my speed on this? I'm not going too fast or anything, we're good? Excellent, thank you. Okay, yeah, please.
When a person is there, you said just being there is helpful. Uh-huh. You gave examples. Why? When a person is able to feel someone's pain or sympathize, what a person is going through, if it's not painful, does that in some way, based on sight, take away from a person's pain? And I don't just mean in terms of moral support, but is there something going on energetically, et cetera, that you...
My guess is, and again, that's why I talked about the study of the holding of the hands. There's something, let me tell you a study that shows, and there are many studies like this, about the power of sharing and being there and the release of prolactin that comes from that. But here's a simple study. They take a group of women who have, it's an autoimmune disorder, who have, I think they have MS. They have MS. So let's say they take a large group of women in MS and they randomly assign them to two groups. So one group is assigned to be the giver, meaning to provide support to the other group. But in the random assignment, they make sure that it's exactly the same level illness. So let's say one woman has moderate level MS symptoms, and the other woman has exactly the same level of symptoms. And one is randomly assigned to say, you help this other woman. Call her up every day, see how she's doing, take her shopping, go with her to the doctor's appointments, just be there for her. And the other woman is assigned just to receive. And they do this with a large group of women with MS. And it's fascinating what happens. Within 4 months, the women who give have significant improvement in the severity of their symptoms, in the waxing and waning course of their symptoms, and in general, their mood improves. But the woman who receives, stays pretty much steady. So it's not a straight line necessarily. If you're there, and if you're there supporting each other, like in the case of a spouse or good friends, it literally does impact at a psychoneuroimmunologic level.
The giver.
The key is the giving. The key is the giving.
It didn't help the person who's receiving.
Right. In this particular study, so I'm making the point that you add to the connection a connection that's mutual and reciprocal. That was a little bit of an artificial study. But that's just one example of how the actual physical experience, what's going on, is changed by support. I'll give you an anecdotal thing. I think this was in Seattle. I was once at a conference, a psycho-oncology conference. And there was a researcher there, a cancer researcher, who had looked at survival rate of children in Seattle who were being treated for leukemia. And it turned out that the Jewish patients, the Jewish children, had the best survival rate. It didn't make sense because in general, religion does not predict survival rates in acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So they try to figure out, how could you explain this? It doesn't make any sense. And it turns out that it's a small, tight-knit Jewish community in Seattle. If somebody was, admitted to the hospital there, they'd be surrounded with the love of the community, with the chicken soup of the community, with visits, hosting families, being there for them. Again, there's something very powerful about that giving component. Okay, part two. So part two goes like this. I just wanted to play off the being there a little bit more. What do you do when you're at somebody's side? And this just comes from talking to a lot of people going through very tough times. I ask them, what do you find that's most helpful, and what do you find that's least helpful? So So say somebody suddenly, there's a bad accident in the family, and somebody is suddenly in a coma in the ICU for an extended period of time, or a sudden death, God forbid, of somebody, or you have somebody who has a child born with severe developmental disabilities, whatever it might be. So what people tell me is that if it's somebody who you were close to beforehand, don't sweat the small stuff. Something as simple as how are you and what do you need? The key, though, is get concrete. It's very hard to take. Let's say somebody experiences a sudden tragedy in their family, a child diagnosed with a serious life-threatening illness. And if you just call and say, let me know, anything I could do to help, let me know. It's not so simple. Most people are not going to feel comfortable asking. They're not used to taking. It's hard to go from spending a life of giving to others to finally taking. It's extremely, extremely difficult. So the key becomes then, what do you do? Try to be specific. If you're going over, find out the children. I spoke to somebody who has a spouse who has a serious chronic illness. So the people who have been most supportive to him recognize that he needs to be in his wife's hospital bed over the last many, many months. So what he finds most helpful is people who say, okay, Tuesday night I'm going to help your young kids with their homework. Or is it okay if I arrange for meals during the week because you're going to be, or I arrange for babysitting. When you get specific, it's much easier to say yes or no to a specific offer of support. So that's one thing that I hear over and over again. And, figure out how you could be of tangible assistance, helping with lifts, homework, cooking, and important to recognize there's no one right way. Sometimes the very thing that is most helpful to one person, it might be a certain kind of support or a certain kind of listening, is not going to be what's helpful to another. The only way to know is to ask them, after you offer them specific things, help me know what's the best way to support you. Okay? And it's often, I'm shocked at how often people say, well, it's been already a year. It's time for you to get over it and move on. I mean, people say really stupid things sometimes, and it's really, really, really upsetting. That resonates, right? Exactly. I mean, it's extremely, I can't tell you how many people, somebody told me that after they lost their husband in a tragic accident, she wanted to write a book called Shiva for Dummies, because people were setting her up already with men during the Shiva. I mean, that's that. You have to, people need some basic education in terms of this. Now, I want to just spend a couple of minutes talking about a little bit about the how hard it is in today's age to really be present in being Nosei Ba'olam Chavero and sharing the burden of others. I'll share with you a study that came out in the July 4th issue this year of Science Magazine. It's a series of 11 studies, and you're going to love this because you'll hear what they did. Simple study. They take kids, college-age kids, older people, senior citizens, all ages, and they say, stay alone. They take away their cell phone. They put them in a room that has nothing there but a table and a chair, nothing to do. And they say, just be alone with your thoughts. Think about your life a little bit for between 8 and 15 minutes. And you'd not be surprised. It's about being, not doing. It's like Shabbos. It's about being, not doing. Okay? And people hate it. That's not surprising. People hate just being as opposed to doing. But here's where the studies get really weird. The psychologists doing this study take an electric shock machine that delivers mild electric shock. I don't know how this got through the ethics committee, but it delivers mildly uncomfortable electric shock. And they put the machine in the corner of this office, and they say, look, be alone here with your thoughts for between 8 and 15 minutes. Think about your life or whatever. Oh, and by the way, if you're really, really bored, okay, don't feel any pressure. You could shock yourself. Do you know that 62% of the men chose to shock themselves and 25% of the women? we're living in a generation that it's hard to really be present. It's hard. There's something 1,000 years ago that Rabbeinu Bachya said. He said it's a four-word prayer. Hashem Yatzileni Mipizur HaNefesh. God save me from fragmentation of my soul. Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Weinberg here wrote in an article last year an amazing thought. When we say in Kriya Shema a few times a day, the two words Vi'avadetem Mehera, it's part of Shema, and it means what it means. But he says another way, he quotes the Baal Shem Tov as saying, another way of looking at Vi'avadetem Mehera is get rid of the rush in your life. Being present, because by the way, empathy, true empathy, can only come with focus and emptying your head out of anything else, just literally being there, listening. Listen to the, this is the only reason I was going to put up a PowerPoint, just to show this one PowerPoint. If anybody wants to see it afterwards, I'll show it to you. But, and when I post it, you'll see it, okay? I just came across this a week and a half ago. It's fascinating. Chinese word character for listen. Okay? You want to hear what goes into the word listen in a certain dialectic of Chinese? It's the following characters. It's the character for ear, not surprising. But then, it's the character for king. A king telling you that you should listen to the person in front of you as if he was the king. The next character is the Chinese word character for the number 10. Sorry about my cold. The number 10 is that be observant as if you had 10 eyes. And there's total focus. Then if you see this line, over here? It's a single line, meaning broken, undivided attention. And then finally, the final symbol is the Chinese symbol for heart, meaning listen with your heart. In Hebrew, the Hebrew word ozen, ear, and the Hebrew word masnayim, a scale, are etymologically from the same root. There's something very balancing about truly listening to somebody in the ways that the Chinese word character tells us. Listen to this. They show a videotape to a group of people of something painful happened to somebody. They show, like, let's say, an adult who has a car door slammed on their fingers. Just even hearing about it, you probably wince. Or a piano lid slamming down on somebody's fingers. We wince. But then they show a video of one person being cruel to another, socially excluding them, saying something cruel and not nice to them, and you don't wince. Because they find that in order to have true empathy for emotional as opposed to physical pain, you need focus. It takes time to process it. It takes active effort. Here's a study and a story, okay? And then I'll just do a study for the sake of time, because there are a few other ones I want to make. It's a study where they do something upsetting, mildly upsetting, to a group of fourth grade girls. And they then have half of them randomly assigned to call their mothers for comfort, and half of them are randomly assigned to text their mothers for comfort. They then measure levels of cortisol, stress hormone, blood pressure, pulse rate, all the physiologic correlates of stress. It turns out the sterile words of texting does nothing to calm them down. But the soothing voice of the mother, with the very same words used in the text, totally chills the girls out. Okay? Stress hormone goes down. Blood pressure goes down. Pulse rate, galvanic skin response, all the way we measure stress. Again, and in recent research done in Haifa, they find it's almost always by being there, mainly through looking at people. Like it says in Mishlei, Kamayim Hapanim Alpanim Kein Leifa Adam, you have to literally be present. It's harder to do in 2014 in Tavshinayin Hay than it used to be before. Okay? So we're good with that? I think I made that point probably too much. And I'll just end it with a with a story, and then I'll move on to the final 2 points. Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories on just being there. A couple of years ago, I was giving a talk in Baltimore, and an eighth grade Rebbe comes over to me, because we were talking about something related to what we're talking about here, and he said, "I have a great story for you." He said he's been teaching now for the last 15, 20 years, and he has a custom that he's been doing since he started teaching, that he buys a bunch of birthday cards for the students in his class who are struggling. They may have an emotionally ill parent, they may have bad financial difficulties, they may have terrible illness in the family, whatever. It might be a high conflict divorce, it could be any one of a number of things. He says it takes him very little time, but he keeps a list on his smartphone of when each student, you know, over the last number of years has a birthday. And he has the cards ready, and he writes a couple of notes saying, "I just want to let you know, I still think of you, I have such fond memories of when you're in class," and he mails it to them. Very nice. He says it takes him literally under 2-3 minutes. He said the week before, he gets a phone call from a kid who 15 years earlier had been one of his eighth graders. He says to him, "Rebbe, you saved a life last night. You saved a life." This is what he's talking about. He said, "You know, I've been having a hard time. I'm living all alone. I'm totally isolated. My life's not going well. I'm not going anywhere with my career or with relationships. I've had a tough time. You know why? You remember, you were always there for me, but I just gave up." He said, "Finally, I decided I'm gonna kill myself. I go into the bathroom. I take a bunch of pills that I know would be lethal, a bunch of antidepressants I'm on, and I go to my bed, fully intending to make that my last minutes on this earth. And as I'm taking the pills with a glass of water in one hand and the pills in the other, and I start to put them in my mouth, out of the corner of my eyes, I see on display in a shelf in my studio apartment 15 birthday cards that you sent me over the last 15 years. And I think to myself, I matter. I matter. Somebody cares about me." And without even thinking, I run to the bathroom, I flush the pills down the toilet, and he said, "The reason I'm calling you tonight, Rebbe, is to take a solemn oath, I will never do that again." It's the power of being there over the short term and over the long term. And that brings me to the last 2 points. The penultimate point has to do with when you're there for somebody in the short term, remember, they may need you even more in the long term. Somebody who lost a spouse in 9/11 told me that she was drowning in everybody's chicken soup in the 6 months after 9/11. But then at a certain point, about a year or so later, she'd notice that all of her old friends, when they'd see her walking down the street, they would cross the street to avoid her. Not because they're bad, but because she made them uncomfortable. And it was a reminder to our fragility. And you often have to combat that. I'll tell you a story and then the obvious recommendation. Embedded in the story is a recommendation. I saw a kid whose father had died about 3-4 years earlier. It's not why he came to see me. His mother was having problems managing him. He was pretty rebellious. He was a 16-year-old kid going to a gray hat yeshiva. What do we call that? YU Machmer, they call it nowadays, okay? So it's gray hat. Maybe black hat, it depends what part of YU Machmer. The YU Connects profile, we have about, what is it, how many different kinds of choices? And I know they show something like that. And they showed it to some of the Russia yeshiva at YU. Where would you put yourself on this menu of choices? Not even Rosh Yeshiva could answer. They had no idea where they fell. So that says something about the way we categorize people. So I'm sitting with the kid after I was seeing him for a while, and I don't know what made me do it, because it wasn't why he came. I said, "You know what? Tell me about a typical Shabbos in your life." I had no reason to ask. I just had a feeling. And remember, this is years after his father's death. So he looks at me like as an idiot. "You finally asked." He said, "Friday night, I go into my room, I plug in the headphone on my computer and I watch whatever game is online, whatever, you know, giant game or whatever I watch. I'm on the computer. This is a kid going to a black hat yeshiva. I said, what about your mother? She said, she's in her room crying. I said, what about your other siblings? Everybody's in their room. They're probably doing what I'm doing. So I said, wait a second. I said, what about shul? You don't go to shul. You don't make kiddush. He said, shul. He said, I don't have any place to sit in shul. Every time I go in there, I'm just reminded of my father's absence. Other people took over that seat. It's just a reminder. He said, and kiddush, you want me to make kiddush? At the beginning, every time I'd make kiddush, all my mother would do was cry. All my mother did was cry. I got permission from the mother and the kid to make two phone calls. We have a wonderful community. I called the head of his yeshiva. I called his rabbi. And what the mother told me is that she was inundated with nonstop invitations in the 6 months after she was widowed. She kept saying no because she wasn't ready for it yet. But then when she was ready a year or so later, nobody called. And there were plenty of men offering to invite her son over and to have him sit next to them in shul, but it stopped. So you have to think long term when there's a death. And one last story about the long term is many years ago, there was a father and mother came to me. She was in end stage of cancer. She had maybe a couple of months left to live, and she had a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old who she brought to see me. And I saw them, and you know, they both wanted me to help prepare the kids for her death and to just get ready. She's a remarkable, remarkable woman. And she died. And I saw the kids for a couple of months, but they seemed to be thriving. The best predictor of how a child does after the loss of the mother is how well the surviving parent does. And this was a wonderful father. So I said, come, I have an open door policy. You can come back whenever you want. But I don't see any reason to see the kids nonstop. So I don't see the kid for 6 years. 6 years later, I get a call from the father saying, I don't think this has anything to do with my wife's death. But my then 6-year-old, who's now 12, who's always been a very well-behaved kid, started acting up terribly in class. I don't know why, but he remembered seeing you, and he said he'd like to come talk to you. And let me just tell you what happened, and with that I'll end the penultimate point, okay? Here's what comes out. His Rebbe, we just had Rosh Chodesh benching this last Shabbos. His Rebbe asked the question, why in Rosh Chodesh benching do we say Male Mishalos Libenu Lutova? Fulfill the wishes of our heart for the good. Why the word Lutova? It's redundant. And the Rebbe said, be careful what you wish for. You know, sometimes you wish to win the lottery. Depression rates go all the way up a year after winning the lottery in many people. The kid didn't know why it upset him, but as I'm seeing him, here's what emerges. He knew his mother was going to die. However well a 6-year-old could understand that. He was spending as much time with her. She was on home hospice care. And on the last day of her life, she might have been a little under-medicated. And he sits on her bed to just be with her. And she says, Joey, I need some space, please. I just need to be alone for a little while. So he leaves the room, slams the door, and just wishes to himself, I just wish she'd die already. She died a couple of hours later. And what went underground, because he wasn't ready to deal with it, he was a preschooler. You know, preschoolers just don't necessarily, they're not quite ready for it yet. But when he was thinking with an adolescent brain at age 12, it was triggered by what the Rebbe said, which was great. And then once we processed it and talked about it, he was fine again. You know, he was sad, but fine. That's what we have to think about the long term. Any good friend of yours, any relative of yours going through an ongoing trauma, it is never in bad form to check up on them. How you doing? How's everything? Put your arm around them. Remember that root system. And I'll end the final point, and I could talk about this topic forever, but I'll end with it. Just a little bit. Sometimes I find that we're uncomfortable with the raw emotions of people who are having a hard time. We're uncomfortable with their tears. Remember, I was talking about the need sometimes to just be by their side. I'll share with you some new research on tears, and I'll end with a story. Here's the research on tears. We now know that emotional tears have in them stress hormones. When we cry, stress hormones are released. Okay, it's why the Gemara in Brachos says, Agra de'hespeda yalul, it's talking about the reward for different actions. And very cryptically it says, you know what the reward is for giving a hesped, if you're eulogizing somebody? It's the wailing, it's the crying. What does that mean? It means the crying can make us feel better. Crying is therapeutic. After the Yom Kippur War, a group of Israeli therapists followed women who lost their husbands in combat in the Yom Kippur War, and they followed their kids into adulthood. They found that when a child grew up in the house where the mothers continued to cry, even if they remarried, every once in a while, if they modeled allowing their children their tears and continued to have a picture up of the husband who died, even though they now have a new husband, those kids had better long-term outcomes. Okay? And it makes sense. Makes sense, okay? So I'll end with the story. It's not my story, it's Rabbi Lau's story, right? In his biography. And I just find it so amazing in terms of the wisdom of this. But I'll start with what we know about tears. Here's what we know about tears. 4-year-old boy lost in a supermarket down the road, let's say. Let's say she's looking, or he, I said boy, he's looking for his mother. He's not crying, he's in fight or flight. If you had a picture of his nervous system, he's now wanting to survive. He won't cry at all. He'll look, he'll look, he'll look. The second he sees her, what does he do? Breaks into tears. What's happening? When he sees her, he could go from fight or flight into a place of comfort and moving on. Tears only come when we're ready to move on, the tears of Nechama. It's why many people say, Yosef cries in these parshios. Binyamin cries. The other brothers don't cry at all. You look through the parshios, you'll never see the other brothers crying. They didn't have the resolution that you need to go to tears. Yosef did. Binyamin did. So Yalkut Yehuda, I talked about this once here a number of years ago. Fascinating, fascinating insight. Here's the story I'll end with. When Rabbi Lau, as a young kid, gets out of the camps, saved by his older brother who died a few weeks ago, Rabbi Lavi, Ambassador Lavi. So he's now, like, I don't know, I think like 9 years old or something. He was like very young. And he and a bunch of other child survivors are put in an orphanage, a Jewish orphanage in France. And there's a very loving house mother taking care of them. They love her. You know, you can imagine, they didn't have any maternal care in those horrible years in the camps, and they love her. But she comes to them, and she says, a group of French Jews want to have a special asifa for you guys to honor you. We want to honor you. We want to give you presents. And the kids, who didn't understand why they suffered without anybody saving them, the kids say, no way, we don't want presents from them. Where were we when we needed them? We're going on strike, we're not coming. And she said to them, look, do it for me. I'll look terrible if you don't come. You don't have to smile. You don't have to accept the gifts. Just show up. What does Woody Allen say? 90% of life is showing up. Show up. So they go. And they're stone-faced. And one French man and one French woman after another is getting up to talk, give these flowery talks. And the kids are just not, they're just not responding. Finally, they invite an elderly survivor to get up. He gets up behind the pulpit, and he just starts to cry. And all he says in the speech, he says, Kinder, Tyra Yiddisher Kinder, dear sweet Jewish children, and he breaks into tears. Rabbi Lau writes that at that point, suddenly, one of the child survivors starts to cry, and then another, and then another. And pretty soon, every child survivor is wailing, wailing nonstop. They don't stop. And the French are terrified. What have we unleashed here? What happened here? And nobody knows what to do because it's just not ebbing. It's just going and going and going. Finally, the oldest child, who was evidently a genius, who he talks about later in the biography, gets up. It must be like a teenager. And he recites by heart the Perek in Nach of that Samos Yevashos, of the dry bones brought back to life. And he says, let me explain to you what's happening here. He said, until now, we were just dry bones. We were lifeless. And we didn't want your presence. But what this survivor just did for us is he brought us back to life. He took our dry bones and gave us the gift of tears. This is the first time we were able to cry since the horrible day that we were shipped off to the camps. So, in terms of that take-home message, I don't want to leave on a negative note. I want to leave on a positive note. Positive note is, be there for people. Don't judge their tears. Don't judge how they're coping. People find the way that copes. They can cope with the best. And just by, ultimately, being nose bolum chavero, you're doing much more than you could imagine. Thank you, everybody. Thanks. Thank you. Yes, thank you.